As I said, I will be speaking on the question of what it means to be a Buddhist. And I should first admit that that is a fairly presumptuous thing to give a talk on. First, because I believe that the meaning of being Buddhist is beyond my ability to know. And furthermore, it deepens with each moment of training, let alone each year. And I have no idea where that is going to go for me, so I certainly cannot predict where it is going and leading for you. And secondly, it is somewhat presumptuous because I think perhaps the meaning of being Buddhist is to some degree unique to each Buddhist. So, with the understanding that I am not telling you what this should mean to you, nor am I giving the be-all and end-all of what it means in some universal sense, I would like to give a few observations, perhaps, of my own in the general area of what it may mean to be Buddhist. The first observation is that our reasons for becoming Buddhist and for re-becoming Buddhist at each moment of training, our reasons are important. They are perhaps part of what it means to be Buddhist. Now, often we cannot say what those reasons are. Indeed, if you ask Buddhist trainees, the longer they've been doing it, the less satisfactory the answer tends to be. You get such things as, well, duh. I have nothing better to do. To which the usual typical response is, well, how about this, that, the other? But, no, that wasn't what the person meant by I have nothing better to do. It meant in this whole wide world, I perceive nothing higher than to do the simple acts of Buddhist training. So even though we cannot necessarily come up with a coherent answer of what our reasons are, they're there. And again, they are as individual as we are. Nonetheless, it occurs to me to say a few things about them, these reasons. They appear to be basically of two types. What I call that which pushes us towards Buddhism and that which pulls us or draws us toward it. And of course, oftentimes, probably most times, some of both. What do I mean by the push? I mean that there is something about life that is unsatisfactory. There is a background dis-ease. The Buddha called it dukkha, pain, suffering. But those are simply translations that don't capture the full thing. Frustration, unhappiness. It's often not a foreground thing. It's often something that one is aware of only in quiet moments. It's a background thing. And yet, for some of us, it is there in our awareness sufficiently strongly that we become willing to give up the old ways, the familiar ways of life, and risk the unknown. Because that is one of the things characteristic of Buddhist training. It takes us always into and further into where we cannot see ahead. It is unknown. This is the classical way of the four noble truths. The first noble truth of dukkha, as I mentioned. The second noble truth that the Buddha discovered at his own enlightenment was there is indeed a cause of this background dissatisfaction. And that cause is simple. In an ever-changing universe, we try to hold on. And that is an impossibility. That very act dooms us to frustration and unhappiness, so long as we do it. And his third noble truth, the obvious conclusion of that, well, you cannot change the universe, you cannot change change, but you can change holding on. There is something that can be done, and that is sufficient. To let go is to find true peace, true satisfaction, and the end of suffering. This way of push, then, essentially is a wisdom way. It is that at some level in our being, we recognize these properties of the universe. And we recognize them enough, and they are real enough, that we are motivated to do something about it in a big way. The pull is that there is, for some of us, something that draws us towards itself. A sense for some that there's more. I don't know how, I don't know where, but there's more. This life as I know it is not all there is. For some, the pull comes from a little glimpse of something more. A glimpse that is so wonderful that we are really willing to risk everything to follow it. I would say that this way of the pull is a way of love. Love of truth or love of love, of spiritual love. Because those seem to me to be the two primary dimensions of this something that draws us towards it. So, from this, it occurs to me that one meaning of being Buddhist is simply that we take the risk of following the push or the pull or the both and walk on into the unknown. For those of us who are pushed, it means willingness to give up all attachments, to let go of all delusions. For as Lord Buddha said, this is the way he found to true peace. It is the only way that he found to true peace. Now, what do I mean by give up? Well, I don't mean to kill off. I don't mean battles of historic and heroic proportion going on inside oneself. It's tempting to take that approach for some of us because it sounds quick and it's a bit romantic, but it is to kill a piece of ourself. Yes, our attachments and our delusions. What's wrong with killing them? Because they are what's there. That's what's wrong with killing them. They are what we have to work with. They are the gift of what we have to work with. They are not to be killed. They are to be let go of indeed, but not by force and not by violence, lest we do violence to all things inadvertently. By giving up, I also do not mean fixing oneself. This, again, is a tendency many of us have. There are two things wrong with it: fixing and oneself. Fixing, among other things, implies I know better. I know what to do here. I have a plan. That's a very sound plan. I mean, it comes right from the Buddhist books, so what's wrong with that? What's wrong with it is that it's a plan. And it does not come from that which draws us to the truth. It comes from our own ideas. And no matter how good those ideas are, they're still ideas. They are not the fullness of our being. And of course, the other half of fixing oneself is the self part. No matter how fixed oneself is, it's still a self. Very bright and shiny, but it's still self. It is still a limitation. And it is the very thing which, around which, it's the very seed crystal, for a chemical analogy, around which all of the attachments form. And for those of us who are pulled, it is the very thing which separates us from the beloved by putting a boundary. It also, giving up, does not mean denying the existence of attachments and delusions. They don't go away because you don't recognize them. On the other hand, it also does not mean simply indulging them, feeding them, justifying them, or letting the whole thing slide. We sort of have a semi-set of opposites here. The kill it, fix it side, and the oh, it doesn't really matter, let it slide, or I'll go along with it side. There's something else that letting go, giving up, means. This comes from what Rev. Master Jiu frequently spoke of as a third position. It's not a compromise, it's something different. It means, to me, each time that we recognize that we're holding on to something, first we recognize it. Yes, that's what I'm doing. Yes, I want that. Yes, I have a squirrely opinion about this. There it is, right there. The second thing is accepting that. I've already sort of implied that. Yes, it's there. It really is there. I actually do want that. I want it a lot. Or, I really am scared of that. Okay, fair enough. Accepting what's there. Because what's there is all there is. It's what we have to work with. If we don't recognize it and don't accept it, what in the world chance do we stand? It's what's there. And then, having recognized and accepted, we gently release our grip. Nice metaphor, Daiswi, but how do you do that? Well, it's actually simple to describe. Actually, it's simple to do. It's just not easy to do. You do that by doing what needs to be done, and by abstaining from what needs to be not done, and at the same time, not entirely believing the voices of greed, anger, fear, delusion. And these two things are done together, the doing of what needs to be done, abstaining of what needs to be not done, and the not entirely believing the voice of greed, anger, fear. In other words, to let go, to gently release our grip, is to do what is just obviously wise, regardless of what we want, what we resent, what we fear, or our strange notions about it. It would be very simple to think of if there were a formula for this, but there isn't. Many years I have flip-flopped back and forth between the simple formulas of, well, always do what you want, and never do what you want. I mean, if one isn't the way, the other must be, right? Never do what you're afraid of, or always do what you're afraid of. Those are equally stuck, equally tightly grasped. What we're speaking of here is simply seeing as clearly as one can just what lies in front of one and what is truly needed right now in this situation, and doing it whether one wants to or not, whether one is afraid of it or not, rendering the desire, the fear, the delusion irrelevant to our actions. That's what I mean by releasing our grip for those of us who are pushed. What about those of us who are pulled? I would say that what seems to be needed here is the uncompromising search for truth and or spiritual love. Well, search for, okay, what's that? Again, it's easier to say what it isn't. It's not digging around and trying to find something. Because that, again, is something that one is in control of. I know how to find it. I will create it or discover it. But you see, it is calling us. It's not the other way around. So the more we get involved in digging and trying, the further we get away. It also does not mean this uncompromising search. It does not mean to have or to know either truth or love, because they cannot be had. They're bigger than that. And they cannot be known. They're bigger than that too. Again, it also does not mean to fix oneself. Nor, I'm afraid, does it mean to create ideals. I say that sadly, as in dyed-in-the-wool idealist. They're just more statements of want. They aren't what is. It does mean allowing oneself over time to accept what truth and love are, and simply accept them for what they are. And what Buddha said about them is that they are basic. They're basic. They're fundamental to Buddha nature. Fundamental to what you may call the great Dharmakaya, Vairochana Buddha, the eternal, the cosmic Buddha, or simply it. They are fundamental properties of enlightenment itself. So it means accepting them for that. Where does that take us? Well, Buddha said something rather interesting about the fundamental properties of enlightenment. He said that they are unborn, uncreated, and unconditioned. This then applies to truth and spiritual love. If they are unborn, then they are undying. They are eternal. If they are uncreated and unformed of other things, then they are truly void of all that can be known and all that can be grasped. And because of that, they are pure. They are as they are, and tranquil within that purity. And if they are unconditioned of other causes, then it follows that they are complete as they are, and therefore are a true refuge. In other words, they are our true nature. There's nothing to look for. It's already there. And not only are they our true nature, they are stable and they are reliable. They are, to use another metaphor, which will tell you what I've been doing recently, the default setting. They are, truth and spiritual love, are that to which we inevitably return when the stuff that gets in the way, the stuff that hinders, is set aside. The stuff that gets in the way comes and goes. But it never lasts. Now, we can hop from one hindrance to another, and frequently do, but no one hindrance stays, because the hindrances are born, created, and conditioned. What those who are pulled towards truth, towards love, need to do, therefore, is simply to stop getting in their own way. To drop off the hindrances, which are what? Greed, anger, fear, delusion. Sound familiar? The very same things that are to be given up, let go of by those of us who come from the push side. In other words, whether we come from the push or from the pull, or both, one thing I think I can say about being Buddhist is that it means the same thing. It is the setting aside, the giving up of the hindrances, attachments, delusions. For those of us who are pushed, we do this as the way to true peace. For those of us who are drawn and pulled, it is the way to truth. The two ways are the same. And at the point of enlightenment, the two goals are the same too. For the true peace is truth. And true love is real contentment. Well and good to talk about all that, but I at least could use a little help doing it. That, for me, is where the ism of Buddhism comes in. Now, isms are difficult things, and many of us, including myself, are somewhat wary of isms, and with good cause, because in our own lives and in the history of humankind, much damage has been done in the service of isms. I've come to think of them more or less analogous to medicines. Taken properly and wisely, they can be lifesavers. abused, they can do very grave damage. But I, for one, do not refuse a medication because it could be abused. It's up to me not to abuse it. It's up to me to use wise discernment and accept it as something helpful. So that is what I see the ism of Buddhism as. It is a helpful thing. Is it the only way towards these goals is a bad word? No, probably not. But it's the way the Buddha found that works. And it is a way that has been followed for 2,500 and some years by those who have gone before us. And they have found it helpful. And they have helped to refine it for us. And they are as we are, honest human beings trying to do their very best. And we have the benefit of their experience, encapsulated and summarized in the ism. And perhaps the most core ism, or core teaching of the Buddhism side of things, is that fourth noble truth of the Buddhas, the Eightfold Path. It's simply a proven effective way of letting go of attachment and finding both truth and peace. Why is it so effective? I suspect it's effective for many reasons. One of them is that it works in two directions at once. It works both from within our inner being outwards towards what we do, and at the same time from our outward behavior inwards to our inner being. And that is good because those two things are connected. Actually, they're not connected, they're inseparable. They're the same thing. There is no inner and outer. But I will speak of inner and outer because it is a useful way of speaking. The path from within outwards are the steps of right understanding, right thought, right mindfulness, and right meditation. These are the subtle ways. They work in ways that I do not understand. I don't even know what meditation is, let alone how it works. All I know is that it has profound effects over time. It seems to undercut the foundations of attachment and delusion. The simple act of sitting still, right in the middle of attachment and delusion, has a revolutionary impact on them over time. And it does take time. Nothing seems to be happening. And yet our teachers keep repeating the same old thing. Just sit. How many times did Reverend Master Jiyu tell me that? Oh, Reverend Master Jiyu. But I want to do something about it. Yes, Dai Sweet, that's part of the problem, isn't it? Just sit. Just be mindful. It's the same old stuff. We hear it again and again and again. But it's true. As a matter of fact, I think that it is the single most powerful thing you can do in the presence of attachment and delusion, is to just be still. Don't even try to understand them. Don't try to fix them. Don't try to push them away. Don't run after them. Don't feed them. Don't distract yourself with guilt about them. Just sit still. And nothing happens, or so it seems. But something is happening. Something is happening. It is undercutting the roots, the foundations of the attachment. Now, the steps of the Eightfold Path that work from our outward behavior inward towards our inner being are right speech, right action, right livelihood, and right effort. These are much more direct. They are much more obvious in their effects. We stop acting on the attachments and delusions and start acting on the basis of something else. What's the something else? A set of rules? Well, you can take it that way if you want to, but they're a lot more than just a set of rules. They are descriptions of enlightened action. They are descriptions of Buddha acts. They are descriptions of the way Buddhas are. Therefore, to act from these steps of the Eightfold Path also has profound effects. Now, these are very large, right? Speech, action, livelihood, and effort. And one of the things that Buddhism has come up with over the centuries is a handy, portable pocket version of those, of a whole half of the Eightfold Path. It's called the Precepts. It's a summary of half of the whole thing. So by combining meditation and mindfulness and care with right thought with those precepts, we get the whole picture. And we have to combine them. We have to combine the working from within and working outwardly. It makes no sense to go halfway. It makes no sense to be mindful and meditating and at the same time careless with what we do. Vice versa, it makes no sense to be taking care with the precepts and at the same time be mindless and scattered. You're working against each other. These things work with each other if you do them together. That is why a week such as this is as it is. What are we doing? Mindfulness, meditation, and looking carefully at the precepts. And although they are the handy pocket version, all you have to do is start putting them into practice and they expand into the whole, that whole half of the Eightfold Path. So that perhaps is another meaning of being Buddhist, doing the training of this Eightfold Path. Because it's what has been found to be the single most effective thing we know. To respond to the pull and to the push that lead us onward. Now you will note that there are many people here for this week, in addition to those who are, in quotes, becoming Buddhist for the first time. You'll see why I put that in quotes for a minute. What are they doing here? This is for people who are becoming Buddhist. Well, that's because I think another meaning of being Buddhist is to constantly become Buddhist. It is a never-ending becoming, a work of always walking on, taking the next step. And so, for reasons of that sort, you get teachings such as that of Dogen Zenji, who brought Soto Zen from China to Japan in the 13th century. His teachings such as, always we must be willing to be disturbed by the truth. Always we must be open to never-ending becoming. Always we must be open to being led deeper into the unknown. This, I think, is also why we have the translation that Reverend Master Jiyu and Her Master Koho Zenji did of that famous last lines of the Scripture of Great Wisdom, the Heart Sutra, the Hanyu Shingyo, where they translated it as, and you hear it every morning, going, going, going on beyond, and always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. Get the feel of this constant becoming. Yes, becoming Buddha. Interesting concept. Well, if one meaning of being Buddhist is becoming Buddhist, and we've just seen that becoming Buddhist is becoming Buddha, we can take that one more step. Becoming Buddha is to be Buddha. For this constant becoming, this constant way of practice and training, is what Buddhas and ancestors did, do, and will do for eternity. It is the work of Buddha. It is exactly what Shakyamuni Buddha did after arising from the Bodhi tree. He didn't go off and sit by the river and eat chocolates. There's nothing wrong with chocolate. But what he did was to continue meditation, acting as a Buddha acts, which is summarized by the precepts, carrying his bowl and wearing his robe, which was his way, for the rest of his life. Very, very simple. So becoming Buddha is to be Buddha. And in that sense, one of the other meanings of being Buddhist is very literally being Buddha. That is why I said it is a great privilege to address an assembly such as this, because you are here to become Buddhist. And to me, that means I am in the presence of Buddha. These acts of Buddhist training strike me as being something truly courageous and truly unique to do, because they go against the grain of how life is usually lived. They go against the grain of what we've always been told about how the world works, and they go against the grain of what many, but by no means all, of those around us are doing. Generally, we are either told or come to the conclusion that all of this is too hard. It is foolish even to try. It's pie in the sky. So we distract ourselves. Life can, and unfortunately frequently is, a series of distractions. There are a million of them, and our society produces them in great and splendorous quantity. And if we do that, we do not carry out the true wish of our heart. And in quiet moments, if we allow ourselves a few, we feel that old background dissatisfaction still there. We feel that longing that pulls, still pulling quietly. And there we sit, alienated from both ourselves and the universe, in distraction. This going along with distraction is a very sad thing, and it's usually not a conscious decision. We just let the great opportunity of this minute slip by. And this minute is the great matter. We take the easy and known way. 1 minute after the next, until one day we find that life is slipping out from under us, and this is a source of profound regret. The alternative is to make the great matter appear, to take each moment as an offering, make it an offering of our training, our practice. Offering to what? I don't know. I don't know what. It's one of those things that is a mystery to me. Just I offer it with open hands. This is the minute of now. I will do with it my simple, honest best, and follow the Buddha's way into what I do not know. And to do that simple, honest best with each moment is enough. That was another one of Reverend Master Jiyu's favorite statements. Just do the best you can. And it was what was told to her by her master. And it's easy to misunderstand as being, well, do the best you can and then let it slide. Uh-uh. Doesn't mean that. Oh, well, then, right, follow your ideals and force yourself to... No, doesn't mean that either. Means exactly what it says. Just do the honest best that is available to you at this moment in time. That's all. That's all. The best in the widest sense of best, which includes not killing yourself off to make something happen. That's not your best. That's following a delusion of how things should be. I should be superhuman. I should be able to... No. No. That's not your best. Superhuman isn't good enough. How's that? I use that one on myself sometimes. Sorry, Daisui, superhuman is not good enough. You can do better than that. You can be human. That's better. That's closer. And it is enough. One of the reasons that it is enough is something that, again, Dogen Zenji pointed out. That training is enlightenment. It's a very profound statement, and it grows on one. The training, the doing of these simple things, is enlightenment itself. Do we know that? Generally speaking, no. We haven't the foggiest idea. And in fact, if we did know it, we'd be in some difficulties too. So whether you know it or whether you don't is kind of irrelevant. It's probably better not to know it. It just is. It just is. Each simple act of training is a Buddha act. And each moment of training, of making an offering of one's simple best, is the appearance of the Buddha in this world. So these simple acts of becoming Buddhist, of being Buddhist, these acts of preceptual living, perceptual being is better, of meditative and mindful practice. These moments, these acts, are the highest and most noble thing I know of in the whole wide world. They are the manifestation, the appearance of Buddha. And the scriptures say of the merits of this training that it is the widest and most completely fathomless. They say that the merit of even one such moment of training cannot be measured, that it surpasses an entire life spent in drifting and distraction. Never doubt the worth of each moment of training. It is the great matter itself. Finally, I'll make one more observation about being Buddhist. I think that the sincerity of the intention which brings all of us to practice, to become, to be Buddhist, the sincerity of the intention that brought you here today and brought you here for this week is also the appearance of Buddha in the world. Because the mind that truly seeks the way is the Buddha mind. And one is not necessarily, again, aware or could put into words why you're here. But something brought you, and something leads you to be and to do here. Trust that something. If the mind that seeks the way is the Buddha mind, then the truth, the love, the peace, the satisfaction that you seek is very close at hand. It is as close to you as that simple, honest, inexpressible perhaps, uncomprehended perhaps, wish or intention that brought you here. Do not look for Buddha nature in something great and spectacular. It's right beside you right now. It's not a little woman or man running around inside you that is wise, that you can discover one day. It's as close as the very intention and wish that brings you to be here. I pray that you may always stay true to that wish. It will lead you on. And given that it has arisen, you will never lose it, because it is of the Buddha nature. It is the Buddha nature manifesting, appearing. And the Buddha nature will never abandon you. Just make sure that you do not bury it for too long under things that do not matter. In the end, none of us understand this mind that seeks the way, this simple wish that brings us, because its truth is its depth is unfathomable. But one does not have to understand it. One does not have to know it. One does not have to be able to explain it. All one has to do is trust it. Trust what brought you here. Trust what leads you on, moment by moment by moment. That, perhaps, above all else, may be what it means to be a Buddhist. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to to the scripture of great wisdom.